live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to find out about how, well, the heart, for many people, you're having problems with it. Heart failure, death, is increasing in the last 2 years substantially, according to the CDC. Why? Also, hyperbaric oxygen and ginkgo biloba extract ameliorate cognitive and memory impairment in Alzheimer's. We'll talk about that. Could marijuana replace five major pharmaceutical drugs? Natural Society says yes, and I'll tell you what those drugs are. The war on drugs has cost over $1 trillion. What does that mean? Continuing today to give you some of the insights I believe will be happening in the next 12 months, I'll take a look at the economy from a little different perspective to fill in some of the pieces. Two studies cast doubt on the credibility of medical research from Stanford and Emory Universities. Tomato juice can slash waist size and inflammatory markers in women, China Medical University. The omega-3s, but not the omega-6 fatty acids, lower depression symptoms in a 2,000-person study. That's from a university in Japan. And the omega-3 also, in older adults, is linked to better blood lipid levels. That's good. Also today, time permitting, we'll take a look at Saudi Arabia's head choppers and why not a word out of the White House for what they're doing. Oh, by the way, they're not just chopping off a head. They're also then crucifying the headless body in public and leaving the body there for a period of time. How does that go with the modern skyscrapers and the most expensive jet in the world, private jet, having a headless crucified body in a public square? I guess it's cool because nobody's saying anything about it. We will, as will Robert Fisk. Also today, time permitting, we'll hear what Noam Chomsky has to say about ISIS. And the Tea Party got a call out and is saying it's as bad as the American Taliban. Is that true? Is that an exaggeration? We'll hear on that. Also, a mother who worked for Merck, selling drugs, decided to do her own homework on whether or not the vaccine that was being given to her child was safe. She worked on the drug that killed anywhere between 60 to 500,000 people, and she was concerned. We rarely hear from the students who are in the debt crisis. Today we will. Their responses about how they're coping with the debt crisis. So as you see, we have a packed show, and I try to hit in areas that the people listening say they want to know more about. And we hear from all over the world. So let's begin. First off, we start with the idea that anyone who goes on television or in the media is more often than not representing a faction. Now, we may only know the universe they come from or the think tank, but we're never given what is your full financial disclosure. How much are you paid to be here? How long have you been a talking spokesperson? Now, in and of itself, the fact that someone is paid to say something for a corporation doesn't mean that what they're saying is wrong. We have to evaluate that separately to maintain objectivity. But we have found that more often than not, especially with the pharmaceutical industry or the financial industry or the big agri-industries like Monsanto, the public face is generally articulate, well-spoken, frequently likable, except for in some instances where the people are not, but they always carry a heavy pedigree, and they're always holding some studies. Here's the problem. When was the last time anyone actually looked at the studies to see are they accurate? Well, what we do in my office every day, and we do it 7 days a week, is we study the literature, and we distinguish the scientific independent literature, where an industry was not paying for the study, designed the study, and interpreted its results, but rather just looking at what science found. And then we see there's a big difference between the outcomes of independent science versus proprietary science. We're not alone in this. I'm going to quote from an article in PLOS Biology, a major study, from Stanford University and Emory Universities. Quote, "Scientific studies are considered valid only if they can be reproduced by outside teams of researchers who come to the same conclusions using the same independent methods. Two studies released yesterday found major flaws with a large number of research papers in the biomedical sciences, a problem that authors say wastes billions of dollars and slows the pace of life-saving research. One of the studies in the journal PLOS Biology analyzed a random sample of 441 biomedical journal articles published in the last 15 years and found that only one out of 441 included a full protocol of the information necessary for evaluating and replicating the research. One out of 441. Now, scientific studies are considered valid only if they can be reproduced by outside teams of researchers who come to the same conclusion using independent methods. Furthermore, most of the studies did not say where their funding came from and did not establish whether there were any conflicts of interest. Quote, we hope our survey will further sensitize scientists, funders, journals, and other science-related stakeholders about the need to improve these indicators, end quote. That was one of the authors of the study, who included prominent scientist John Leonidas from the Meta Research Innovation Center at Stanford University and Shireen Eibel of the Emory University. Now, a separate study by researchers in Germany examined hundreds of published experiments on stroke and cancer research and found that most did not contain sufficient information about how many animals were used. In many papers, the number of animals used over the course of the time vanished, making any conclusions less reliable. Quote, the study began with an attempt to look at the robustness of findings in a handful of preclinical papers, but the sheer number of missing animals stopped us in our tracks. So, there is, quote, a credibility crisis is ravaging scientific research. For instance, a recent attempt to replicate 100 psychology studies found that only 39% could in fact be reproduced. And other previous research has found, quote, 85% of research investment in biomedical sciences, or $200 billion, is wasted. The journal is launching a new meta-research section aimed at improving statistics. So what does this mean in lay language? Let's go back to the early 1970s. I'm a junior scientist at the Institute of Applied Biology. I was the lowest person on the totem pole. And there were about 17 different research departments and people there, most of them doing research in cancer, pain management for drugs. I was the oddball doing the research on nutrition and seeing what role nutrition could be in improving or lengthening the human life or ending suffering. None of them believed in any of it. When I finished my first major experiment, which took over a year to do, where I fed one group of rats what I considered an ideal diet, and the other got their standard rat chow, and the group that fed the ideal diet but had the same water, same amount of nutrients, same amount of light, and the same everything, my group lived over 26% longer. So the head of the institute said, the only way you'll know if your research is valid or if you made an error is to have someone else duplicate it. So we had a Dr. Berman duplicate it. Same results. And still, now here's the interesting part. Even though I had proved for the first time that I'm aware of, because I studied all the scientific literature, no one had ever done this before, I couldn't get them to submit it for publication because, quote, they didn't believe it. So I asked them to do the research. And it didn't matter. This showed me the power of belief. Then in spite of all the evidence to the contrary, if you don't believe in something, you're not going to accept the outcome that challenges your beliefs. So, example, you have terminal cancer. You go to Sloan Kettering, MD Anderson. They do the best they can. They're very sincere, I believe, in trying to help save your life. But their tools are pharmaceutical drugs, radiation, or surgery. And the vast majority of people die. 550,000, over 500,000 per year, die. Now, they did exactly what they were told to do. They didn't even mention nutrition or anything else. But another small group goes to some doctors who believe that the orthodox approach is wrong, actually contributes to cancer. And lo and behold, with Dr. Lawrence Burton, Dr. Emmanuel Ravisi, Dr. Virginia Livingston Weider, Dr. Al-Kaidi, Dr. Nicholas Gonzalez, Dr. Joseph Issel, Dr. Stanislaw Brzezinski, a percentage of these people, the highest 17% confirmed, the lowest around 6%, they survived terminal cancer. And they're alive and well 5 years later. How do I know? Because I actually followed them for 5 years and followed the patients from beginning to end to show that they did not have a relapse. It wasn't as if they were alive 5 years later and still had the cancer. They had no cancer. Now, these were all orthodox doctors and none of them were holistic. But the orthodox would not accept them. In fact, I was there trying to get the Pan Am Research Group in South America and to get several other major scientific groups, including the National Cancer Institute, to research, duplicate their findings. They wouldn't do it. So I said I would fund a simple study, and I sent this to the director of the National Cancer Institute. Take 100 terminally ill patients where nothing you're going to do is going to help them. You determine that. Then take another 100, equally matched, pancreatic for pancreatic, age for age, and let one doctor at a time do it. And the first doctor was going to be Dr. Lawrence Burton. I'd written an article about him, and then 60 Minutes, Don Hewlett called me. I went in. They used my material. They did a special on Lawrence Burton. So I said, here's a perfect case. You do 100 patients, he does 100. At the end of a year, examine whose patients are alive and well. Neither, both, one, the other. At least you'll have some data, and it won't cost you a penny. They wouldn't do it. Why? Because they already knew the outcome. You see, here is the game that's afoot, and you have to break this into sections to fully understand it. Well-intentioned people. So let's not question their motives. Some people are greedy, but that doesn't mean that they're less interested in seeing a patient survive. That means you can be greedy and exploit a person's disease to your financial advantage, but at the same time you want to see them do well. Or they can be greedy and care less about the patient. Or they can be non-greedy and want to see the patient do well. So you have all these variables. And therefore, one blanket statement simply doesn't suffice. You have to take it on a case basis. And when you're dealing with over 800,000 doctors and a lot of oncologists, and the oncologists can make a lot of money from it, then the question is, why are they doing the therapy? Is it that the patient is a problem? Is the cancer in the patient a problem? Is it the way they're being treated a problem? And no one's ever looking at this. They can't. Because no one individual is powerful enough, influential enough, to challenge those who profit from the disease. Now, in and of itself, you can say, but these are pharmaceutical companies. And yes, and you'll meet them next to you praying in a synagogue or a church. You'll see them, you know, at a function, and they'll seem by all intents and purposes completely normal, just like you. The difference is that when they're in that office, they have stockholders they must be responsible for. Their drug then has to be given a green light. It has to be then put into the hands of doctors. They can wholesale that drug, let's say for $5,000 to $6,000, $7,000, which is about right, per cancer drug, per treatment, single treatment, one time. And the doctor can then, oncologist, turn around and sell that same drug retail at, let's say, $10,000 to $14,000 per treatment. So let's say that you've got 30 rounds of chemotherapy per patient, and you have 200 patients, completely normal. That means that you can make anywhere between $2 to $6 million extra money just from that. Now, the question is anyone actually stepping back and looking at this and deconstructing? Is it ethical? You could argue that. What if people cannot afford that? Even the copays, they'll go bankrupt. And that's a legitimate debate and discussion. What if what they're using doesn't work? Has anyone actually compared the survival rates? Yes, they have. And what did they find? Well, the one person who took several years to do it and published it in a peer-reviewed literature showed that the majority, 80% of all orthodox cancer chemotherapy does not work. Then the question is, and he had studied over 3,200 studies, why are they still using it? And the answer was simple. They believe in it. So then we're given another layer of confusion. You mean science-based medicine has only the pretense of science, but the foundational belief is, do I believe it? Hence, if you believe in something, even if there's no science to justify it, you'll do it. Now, if there's no science but a lot of money, you may be inclined to do it more. Some would not. Now, that's unique in arthritis, rheumatology. You can do that. You can profit off your patients. And in oncology, you cannot in other areas. There are other ways of profiting if you choose to be one of those who would be subordinated to the greed, but I'm guessing the majority of doctors are not. I'm guessing most of them are very ethical and honorable. But the fact is, can you be ethical, honorable, and still give the wrong protocols to your patients? And the answer is yes, and it's done every day. That's why at the end of every single year, American medicine kills more Americans that did not have to die and injures more than all of American casualties in all of our wars. Wow, that's a lot of people to injure. You're talking about more than 10 million. Yeah. And anywhere between 550 to 800,000 dead. That is correct. And I've documented that in a series of scholarly articles called Death by Medicine. So then the question is, well, what do we have to do to change it? And the answer is you can't. There are things in life you cannot change. But there's a particular type of narcissism or determinism or sociopathology that suggests, yes, we can. We can change anything. And I would suggest, be more authentic and spiritual, and you'll see you can't. First, you can't change people who are greedy. You can't change the corporations they work for. You can't change those who will not look at something unless it's supposedly sanctified by science. And now we're seeing science is not a sanctuary of truth. It is a cesspool of corruption and self-interest, most of it. And therefore, those doctors, after 118 separate studies that I did on my own, proving the phenomena of energy exchange, and the first in the world to do it scientifically, and they even have photographs and wrote articles on it, they would not accept it. Not once in all my 33 years did anyone ever say, hey, I learned something, it changes how I'm going to view something, I'm going to change. Instead of being frustrated and burned down and stressed and angry, simply say, is there a different paradigm that is more open to a different approach? And the answer is yes. There are millions of people who have exchanged the energy of one paradigm that no longer works for them, even if it did at one time, to a new paradigm that does work for them. So, tie it all together. The doctors who are the real heroes are not those who go through life treating patients, seeing only modest results, but playing it safe, playing by the rules they were given, adapting to the nomenclature and the linguistics of their profession. The true heroes are those who were there, gave it all up, went into that vortex and had a choice of one or two pills to take, and they took the one that enlightened them, and now they're able to heal more patients than they were before. They pay a price for that: exclusion, ridicule, mocking, attack. But at the end of the day, they've honored the idea that, are they truly going to be able to help a patient? So if the idea was that American medicine is based upon helping patients instead of helping the people who provide the protocols, we would have a radically different way of looking at health. And this study I just gave you supports that. Also, separately from China Medical University, tomato juice can turn down inflammation. A glass of tomato juice for 8 weeks has a direct effect on waist circumference. That's good for overweight people. Cholesterol, that's terrific. And markers of inflammation in generally healthy young women. And data from this study showed that it didn't take a lot of lycopene and what's in a tomato juice, but there was a big difference. 22% decreased levels in monocyte, a protein, which is a powerful inflammatory marker, and this was published in Nutrition. So lycopene, lyco, L-Y-C-O-P-E-N-E, P-E-N-E, very powerful antioxidants, comes in your pink grapefruits and your red oranges and your red peppers and beets and anything red, you're getting lycopene, watermelon, strawberries, raspberries. So that's good. So get your tomato juice or get something red each day into your diet. Also, for those of you with depression, a good study from the Nogaya University in Japan, they found here that in 2,000 people who were depressed, about half men and half women, by taking the omega-3 fatty acids, it was substantially beneficial and reduced depression symptoms overall. And that's a very important thing. Quote, common mental disorders characterized by sadness, loss of interest or pleasure, feelings of guilt or low self-worth, disturbed sleep or appetite, feelings of tiredness and poor concentration, all those were helped. Also, if you want to have better blood cholesterol, omega-3 fatty acids, University of Newcastle, which is in Australia, said, oh, quote, overall, the risk of developing hypertriglyceridemia is associated with lower omega-3 fatty acid status, promoting the importance of omega-3 index for healthy aging. This was published in the Journal of Nutritional Biochemistry. In lay language, it means if you want a healthier blood lipid, blood fat profile, triglycerides, cholesterol, get your omega-3 fatty acids. And that's the latest. Oh, I mentioned hyperbaric at the beginning. Yes, this is a good study from Southeast University in China. And it says that hyperbaric oxygen and ginkgo biloba ameliorate cognitive and memory impairment in Alzheimer's disease. Well, considering how many people in this audience have family members have Alzheimer's, I'm happy to share this with you. Researchers did a study, and they found that it made an enormous difference in helping with cognition and memory. And so make sure that ginkgo, I would suggest 200 to 300 milligrams of ginkgo biloba and hyperbaric for an hour, 3 days a week for about 3 months. That's the latest on health and healing. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. We have a lot to share. I'm going to bring you up to date on Greenland. I told you a long time ago, they cannot predict how quickly those ice shelves, which are 2 miles thick, will begin to gravitate towards calving and fall in. And at a certain point, if it gets warm enough and there's enough water on the bottom acting like a skid, then just imagine if someone put a really thick layer of Vaseline on your shoes and then on you were on a slippery floor, like a pure marble floor, and then you tried to run, you're just going to fall and slide. That's what happened in Greenland. And I said that you could wake up one day and find out that the water has risen because once it starts, there's nothing in the world that can stop it. It started. Here's the latest on this. This is from York University. Quote, climate change altering Greenland ice sheet and accelerating sea level rise. New research has found that Greenland's ice sheet is rapidly losing the ability to buffer its contribution to rising sea levels. Now, the Greenland ice sheet has traditionally been pictured as a bit of a sponge for glacial meltwater, but new research has found that it is rapidly losing the ability to buffer its contribution to rising sea level, and that is very serious. And they're seeing an acceleration between 2012, 13, and 15. And the research was done in conjunction with lead researchers from the Geological Survey of Denmark and also University of Colorado at Boulder, geological survey people. And so, quote, we were interested in the thin, porous, near-surface, firm layer and how its physical structure is changing rapidly with climate change. The study looked at very recent climate change on the ice sheet, how the last couple of years of melt have really altered the structure of the ice sheet firm and made it behave differently to future melt. So what this means, quote, is the ice is moving, and it's moving with the largest movable weight on the planet. Remember, Greenland's big. You could put Texas three times in Greenland. And now you got tens of thousands of mini lakes in the summertime. And that water's going right down the bottom, and that's pulling it forward. So we're going to see Greenland, big chunks melting, and the oceans rising soon, the next 1, 2, 3 years. For those of you who have not involved yourself in the fracking movement, may I suggest you take the time to become informed and do so. This is the latest reason why we should all be opposed to fracking. This is from Sayer G. from GreenMed Info. Quote, fracking wastewater is cancer-causing, new study confirms. The fracking industry likes to call its product natural gas, but the natural consequence of its activity is the production of billions of gallons of cancer-causing wastewater. The new study published in Toxicological and Applied Pharmacology, titled Malignant Human Cell Transformation at Marcellus Shale Gas Drilling Flowback Water, is the first study of its kind to confirm widely held suspicions concerning the carcinogenicity of fracking pollution. The new collaboration study was conducted by scientists at esteemed institutions in the U.S. and China and found the so-called, quote, flowback fracking wastewater induced malignant changes in human bronchoepithelial cells consistent with cancer. And the same fracking wastewater was injected into mice. Same thing happened. So anytime you have a fracking site, you're going to have fracking wastewater. And it is deadly. Now we're finding out, yes, it causes cancer. And why should you be concerned? Well, here's two reasons. The implications of the data presented can be harrowing. Pennsylvania alone has 7,700 active wells in use right now. Over 4,000 violations have been reported and over $6 million in fines paid out thus far. And the operation of these Pennsylvania wells requires 42 billion gallons of water. And That is an enormous amount of wastewater, about 6 billion gallons of flowback wastewater. So the Marcellus Shale formation in the Appalachian Basin, which is by far the number one producer of natural gas in the U.S., and uses the increasingly widespread fracking technique known as high-volume horizontal hydraulic fracking, is responsible for producing not only massive fracking chemicals and heavy metal pollution, but radioactive waste as well. And you get radiation in that wastewater. So that means your wells, your aquifers, that could be there for millions of people, polluted. Oh, and in Oklahoma, the most earthquakes recorded last year on the planet, Oklahoma, because of fracking. Now to a separate issue. On a regular basis, I'll give you pieces of the puzzle, because what I look for is I look for specific trends that are not in and of themselves necessarily earth-shaking, but you've got to link them together to see what is happening. And I believe that we will see this year in the United States a major depression, but not for the people watching the media. They believe that Wall Street and the stock market is our economy. It is not. It has almost nothing to do with our economy. If every bank, if every corporation went broke that played the stock market, it would not impact the average person's lives. Pensions, yes. Those who had gambled in it, yes. I think that we had better be honest about this and take our money out of the market and put it in something safe. First of all, why? Why do I see a depression coming for about 270 million Americans, but not the rest of the population? Because there's not enough demand for all the goods and services. It's that simple. So if you were in the 1950s or 60s, we had so many people wanting to buy things and then spending that money in their local economies. And we bought American, whether it was a Schwinn bike, whatever it was, that was made here, or made with quality labor. We bought it, we used it, and it wasn't based upon obsolescence. Nobody bought a Schwinn or Rally bike thinking it'd go bad in 6 months and we'd throw it away. I still have mine. And a lot of other people still have what they bought because they took care of them. Because when things were made in America at that time, and made in Italy and in Germany and in France and in Sweden and Switzerland and Japan, they were considered quality. The craftsmanship that went into it, the integrity that went into it. Obsolescence wasn't really a part of that for most items. That's changed. We become a throwaway disposable society. Are you aware of the latest statistic that 99% of all the things we buy on Christmas we're not using within 60 days and discarded or broken or thrown away within 100 days? So we're just not producing goods in any longer in America that the majority of Americans can afford or want. Also, do you have any idea who really controls America's economies? It's not Wall Street. They lord over everyone. They're the people who draw attention. But 70% of our entire economic activity comes from the American consumer. The trouble is, we don't have enough purchasing power going from 2015 and 2016 to keep the economy going. The median wage is 4% below what it was in 2000, adjusted for inflation. And that means a continuing slowdown. Now, how will that impact? Here's what you haven't been told. When I got out of college, you were expected to get married, have a family, buy a house, settle down, and be a part of your community, which most people did. Today, you can't afford to get married, buy a house, and have children if you are an indebted student. Now, that doesn't mean there won't be some percentage that will do that no matter what. They will, but the majority are not. As a result, think of all the things that won't get purchased. Well, the awnings and the carpet and the furnishings and the linens and the washer and the dryer and utilities and the concrete and the roofing and the framing, all that won't happen in the same degree that it did at the same percentage. Then you think, okay, that's all right. So the percentage of Americans of working age who have jobs is at a 40-year low. There are over 106 million Americans who could work but aren't for whatever reason. They can't find it. They can't find it at a level that they feel it's worthwhile, or they've just given up. That means that we have an astronomical amount of people, one-third nearly of the entire American population, who don't have that extra money. Where there was a time when you wouldn't have thought twice about going out and buying some clothes or buying something and spending that money, a small amount or a larger amount in your community. Now people have to be more conscious. Also, whatever they're spending today, they're using credit to buy it, and using debt as an asset is fraud. It is out-and-out economic alchemy. And yet we've been led to believe, buy, buy, buy. And you say, but pay us a living wage. And they say, no, 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 we can't do that. But even though you're in debt, go more in debt. We'll make it easy for you. We'll give you liar's loans. We'll give you 1,000% interest on payday loans if you can't pay them back. It's purely mercenary. So you think, okay, the baby boomers, my generation, will bail us out. Well, some of us were financially very conservative. The majority, not so much. As a result, the baby boomers, 76 million, you didn't save enough. You didn't think you'd have to. You probably figured, my goodness, this house is, you know, that I bought for X dollars back in the 1960s or 70s. It's now worth 3-4 times as much. I don't have to worry about that. I got an ATM machine. No, you've got a hole in the ground, and your house is sinking with you in it. So now we have debt, no savings, little savings, and we're not going to bail anyone out. Europe is in a deep recession. China fell off the chart yesterday. Mind you, China just had to devalue itself by 40% in the last 6 months, and now they had to close down their stock market yesterday. It's finally catching up. The largest environmental degradation in human history, they've created. Purchasing the largest amount of minerals in the world, they've done, but at a human cost. They gave people a standard of living, but then gave them no measure of what to do to be sustainable. So they have a high-quality lifestyle, lots of meat and pork and fast food joints and high-rise apartments, but they can't live in those apartments because, gee whiz, they bet upon the stock market, and the stock market went up, and yuan went up, and then it crashed, and they all bought on margin. So you're looking today at probably 300 to 400 million Chinese who are broke, and the government's broke. But they have a lot of gold, the largest gold supply in the world. Don't let anyone tell you otherwise. And they will devalue their currency down to make everything they do produce dirt cheap. And then they'll make deals again, and they'll survive. So the Chinese will actually survive this. Other countries, not so much. Which country do I believe is headed into the deepest depression in its history? Brazil. Yet that's where a lot of people parked their money because they were producing all these great minerals and resources. They were destroying their forest. Hey, there's a big rainforest out there, and there's no political power base there. It's just some indigenous people, and they don't count for anything, right? And they got a bunch of animals. And who cares about the animals? We care about the soybeans genetically engineered, and we care about the hardwood lumber. China wants that. Japan wants that. Nobody wants to be the person that says, maybe we should not tear down Mother Nature, rip out its lungs, because, and no one wanted to say, well, can we start next week, please? I want all that hardwood. I want that. Can we just go ahead and feed all these people with the pork? And the pork needs the soybeans. The cattle needs the soybeans. In Japan, we like to massage the animals, to make them feel really good, to loosen up that meat before we kill them, because we can charge more and it's more kind of aesthetically pleasing. Yeah, you can do all that. How long do you think it takes a forest to come back? You destroy 80,000 acres a day. You can't grow an acre in 30 years. So Brazil, totally corrupt and has been historically, as every country in South America is, and all the sociopaths who run these damn countries, and the ruling elite, and the bankers, and the privatizers, and the International Monetary Fund, and all the people who could exploit any resource, human capital resource, or natural resource, did so. Now it's payback. Brazil, get ready for the big-ass smackdown. I predict that you're going to have your ass smacked from one end of this world to the next, and you deserve exactly what you're getting. You have engaged in genocide against native people. You should be held accountable and shameful, but there is no shame in sociopathic behavior. Your president, all the other presidents, criminals. How many animals, how many species have you destroyed? But I forgot. You only destroy it because you sell it to others. So should we hold China and Japan and Americans and everyone else who buys your commodities well? Any thought about what it costs? So look at, I would predict that the seventh largest economy in the world won't be. China is completely on its back, but Japan is not only totally in the doldrums, but it also has the problem of having Fukushima and radiation. So where does that leave us? It leaves us with understanding that people say, I'm okay, I'm in junk bonds. Really? Well, Third Avenue Management, they did something. They froze withdrawals from their fund, from a $788 million mutual fund, and the mutual fund was loaded with junk bonds. So investors who thought, well, I'm more sophisticated than the average person. I got my money in these junk bonds, these mutual funds, which own the junk bonds, not so smart, because you can't get your money out. Why? Because a lot of that junk bond was based upon buying oil at $115 a barrel, and it's now $37, and it's going to stay at $37 for a long time. So the energy sector is out and down. We have crashes in 80% of all the economies on the planet, and crude prices are dropping. They dropped 35% last year, and they're not going to get back up in a long time. So commodities in the toilet. Canada, the 11th largest economy on the entire planet, it's in a challenged time as Canadian stock is down, and it will continue to go down. China has the second largest economy on the planet, and it will survive, but it's going to have to go way down on the value of everything it offers, and it will. And Europe is had the second worst December ever. Japanese stocks are down 500 points, but not to worry. We have Warren Buffett. Yeah, Warren's not going to go broke, but he lost $7.8 billion in the last 12 months. So corporate profits are plunging. Bond market is really volatile, and nobody should be in it. And if you're a small business owner, you employ more people than any other people, you've noticed how few customers you have and how they can't spend as much as they once did if you live in most places. So also, did anyone pay attention to the velocity of money? You got to watch the velocity of money. That means in lay language that when the economy is running well, money tends to circulate efficiently through the system. And this is according to Mike Snyder. But when the economy gets into trouble, as it is now, people are hesitant, people are cautious, people are scared. So they hold their money, and hence the velocity of that money goes way down from a full-fledged water faucet to a trickle. And that, right now, we're at an all-time low on the philosophy of money. And also, did anyone forget about the middle class? How about everybody forget about the middle class? Big mistake. In 1971, 61% of all Americans live in the middle class. Today, the smallest amount, we're down to 43%. So you destroy systematically the middle class, then you're going to increase the number of Americans living in poverty. Now, we go through this whole process of going into poverty in stages, and it's only when you hit rock bottom that you end up homeless with your children, and then you think, what the hell happened? How many Americans right now are living in poverty? 60%. 60% of Americans, that's the most in America's history, even more than the Great Depression. So are we in enough pain yet? Nope. Are we ready to protest? Not yet. We're not in enough pain. Listen to what I'm telling you. Americans won't do a damn thing about anything except look for sociopaths running for president as long as they can still go and have a fast food meal, wallow around the halls of Walmart, or watch reality TV. We're not in enough pain to protest. Will we ever be? Yes, but that won't be because of poverty that we protest. It'll be because of what's coming. Detention camps for activists or those who are considered a domestic threat. But until that time, no matter how bad it gets, we merely maladapt to it. Back in a moment. No, you know what we're going to do? We're going to go right over now because I want you to hear from some students. The faces of America's student debt. We rarely hear from them. I want you to hear what they have to say because, mind you, this is a generation that is totally screwed. They shouldn't, most people should not be going to college today. If you are a parent, I would suggest before you get your kid into school, before a student goes to school, ask yourself, why am I going? To get a better life? Well, show me the proof that you're going to get a better life because of the debt you're taking on that you've got to pay back. And if you don't, your parents or grandparents have to. And if you can't pay it, someone's going to go to prison because of debtor's prison. And why not learn other trades or other ways of providing an income? I'm absolutely, totally opposed to the idea that everyone should go to college and get an advanced education today. Some people, yes. The majority, no. Here's why. Please listen.
As cumbersome.
Crushing.
Inflated.
Astronomical.
Overwhelming.
It's negative. I'm chained to something for the rest of my life. I have a total of $28,000 in student debt. I have nothing to show for my degree. I have nothing but a huge amount of debt.
I have around $30,000 worth of student debt. It's kind of like a dark cloud that hangs over you.
I currently have probably right around $180,000. I have a law degree, but I am not currently using it.
$280,000 in student debt. And by the time I finish, I'll be at about $300,000.
It brings up a lot of shame. Yeah. It's hard to talk about, excuse me. Because I should have known better. But what I knew is I really wanted an education. I have a 17-year-old. She'll be starting school soon. I'll need to borrow for her. Will I ever get married? What would it mean in partnership?
I wanted to study being a medical assistant. I really enjoyed helping people. It really takes a toll on everything. You know, I don't want to share with people, like, I got a lot of debt. Sorry. It's discouraging. It's embarrassing. I mean, I'm 22. Like, I should not have that much debt. I'm the first person from my family to go to college. And I don't have anything to show for it.
I currently have $81,000 in debt. I didn't end up finishing my degree. When I did get loans, they were never enough to cover rent and food and school because the school costs so much money itself. So I ended up sleeping it out of my car, which made it much, much more difficult for me to do anything at all.
Education was stressed to me from as early as I can remember. Like, you know, my parents are both immigrants to this country, so for them getting a college education is like the holy grail. I do not think that education is worth it. I think nowadays you can teach yourself a lot of things just from the internet and YouTube.
I don't think that I knew the full weight of what I was getting into.
The smoothness of the financial aid office, the sort of crisp cleanliness and the efficiency of it, didn't leave a lot of space for me to think about what I was doing. When I was living on student loans, I saved all of my receipts, then I cast them in bronze. It's almost like as if my debt is like this little weapon. This is a debt rock. And so I feel like, you know, it's something that could be thrown. It's also something that potentially could be worth money.
It says that it'll take until 2036 to pay off my loan.
I mean, it would probably take 30 years, and that 180 would end up turning into probably 250, 275 at the end of the life term.
I've seen estimates anywhere from 4 years if I sell my soul and work crazy hours and make a lot of money, or if it's a little bit more sane path, it might be 8 to 10 years.
I would pay as much as I need to pay to keep my credit, like, not completely f***ed.
I already have anxiety, and it certainly doesn't help. I feel like I've missed out on being able to almost achieve like the quote-unquote American dream.
Keep in mind, the American dream is a lie. It wasn't at one time, it is today. Do not buy a house. I'm suggesting, unless you're very rich and it's just a toy, don't buy a house. Lease a car, don't buy a car. And don't go to college unless you are going to become a medical doctor or some very specific field and you have financing for it. If someone's paying for it, a family member is giving it to you as a gift, fine. Don't incur the debt, because the vast majority of people going to school today will not have a job when they get out. We're going into a major depression, not a recession, a depression for 270 million Americans, and debtor's prison will grab you off the street with SWAT teams, and then you'll say, how's this possible? And I'll say, didn't you pay attention to the people who were running for office? Didn't you pay attention to state legislatures controlled by ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council? Didn't you pay attention to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, NAFTA, GATT? Didn't you pay attention to the major media and the cable media, all liars and sociopaths? Didn't you pay attention to Fast Food Nation? Didn't you pay attention to exploitation of our school system to privatize it? Didn't you pay attention to anything? And they'll say, no, I was busy. Well, that's why I'm asking people, don't indebt yourself. Get out of debt, and you'll see why in the coming future. Also, tonight at 7 o'clock on the Progressive Commentary Hour, the most listened show I do of the week, Professor Peter Dale Scott and I will discuss the history of the deep state activities, the U.S. intelligence agencies, our presidents, and how they've all engaged in undermining our freedoms. You'll learn about that at 7 p.m. Also, I'm going to be interviewing people to hire I have a lot of tech people. I'm going to hire another tech person who's really smart about computers and the internet. And you want to be considered, you'll call 646-926-5422. We're going to close out today by listening to a challenge on the Tea Party of what it claims its virtues and values are, very similar to Ayn Rand, who was a total nut job. I knew her. Total nut job. And maybe you should rethink how extreme a thought process is when you consider someone who is poor or someone who's out of work. It's just being lazy. Because I know an awful lot of people who are working two jobs who are not lazy, and examine the real nature of power to understand why we should hold a lot more compassion and a lot more sense of humaneness towards those who are suffering. Listen in.
Congressman Alan West of Florida. I must confess, when I see anyone with an Obama bumper sticker, I recognize them as a threat to the gene pool. They believe in loving America, but hating its government. Conservative activist Grover Norquist.
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I could drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
And they believe that anyone who disagrees with the Tea Party has sinister anti-American motives.
The objective of the liberals is to destroy this country. The objective of the liberals is to make America mediocre.
Most of all, you must never, under any circumstance, seek to reach a compromise with your opponent or do any of what Democrats and genuine Republicans both call governing. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell.
Our top political priority over the next 2 years should be to deny President Obama a second term.
And one other plank in the Tea Party platform. If you're poor, it means you're either too lazy or too stupid to be rich. Here's Andre Bauer, Tea Party leader and Lieutenant Governor of South Carolina. My grandmother was not a highly educated woman, but she told me as a small child to quit feeding stray animals. You know why? Because they breed. During Tea Party rallies and campaign speeches, we've been told that America was founded as a Christian nation, and that if the Founding Fathers were here today, they'd tell us so. Here's John Adams in the Treaty of Tripoli. As the government of the United States is not, in any sense, founded on the Christian religion. And here's Thomas Jefferson. That our civil rights have no dependence on our religious opinions.
And here's the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion.
What's more frightening than the perversion of our great history is that sensible, smart, strong Republicans, the very men and women who should be standing up to radical fundamentalism, are so frightened of losing primary battles to religious zealots that they've thrown in the towel on sanity. So we get this.
Yes, that the Constitution established the United States of America as a Christian nation.
It's ironic because the biggest enemy of the phony Republican isn't Nancy Pelosi or Harry Reid or Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama. It's this man. He said, heal the sick, feed the hungry, care for the weakest among us, and always pray in private.
Ideological purity. Compromise is weakness. A fundamentalist belief in scriptural literalism.
Denying science. Unmoved by facts. Undeterred by new information. A hostile fear of progress. A demonization of education.
A need to control women's bodies. Severe xenophobia. Tribal mentality. Intolerance of dissent and a pathological hatred of the U.S. government.
They can call themselves the Tea Party. They can call themselves conservatives. And they can even call themselves Republicans, though Republicans certainly shouldn't. But we should call them what they are, the American Taliban.
Believe it or challenge it, we'll open that up for discussion about the power of image in politics. And who was the person who said that the American Constitution was based upon religion? That was John McCain. And he's still there. And he's meeting with members of ISIS. And those are the so-called moderates. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.
I remember my first love affair. Somehow or another, the whole darn thing went wrong. But my mama had some great advice, so I thought I'd put it in the words of this song. I can still hear her saying,